The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, an interview with Pauline Kayes on diversity education, and a look at controversial research that will take place at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Stay tuned. In another installment of her Good to Know series, IMC reporter Andine Gross talks to Pauline Kayes about the challenge of diversity education.
Good to Know, a series of conversations with diverse members of the Champaign-Urbana community who work to build community. Pauline Kayes is the president of Diversity Works, Inc., and the writer of the Musings and Ravings column for the Champaign-Urbana weekly newspaper called The Paper. Her work in the past few decades has focused on promoting diversity education in schools and the workplace. Welcome, Pauline Kayes.
Thank you, Andine.
Pauline, tell us about your background and what got you interested in doing diversity work.
Well, that would take a few days, but basically my orientation towards thinking about diversity started with my family. My mother's family came from Poland and Czechoslovakia. We're living in South Chicago in a neighborhood called Hegwisch, which is the east side. And my father's side, Irish and German and Native American, were also living in Hegwisch. So it was the interaction of those families, like my father's family, because they were Irish, always thought they were better than my mother's family, who were Polish. And so I was surrounded in that South Chicago neighborhood with Lithuanians and Romanians and Croatians and Irish and Polish and German, and they all had such ideas about whose food was better and who was a better person and who cleaned better. And as a kid, I remember that just seemed so weird to me. And then we moved to Hammond, Indiana, East Chicago area, which is right across the state line. And Mexicans were moving into our neighborhood at that time. And my mother would constantly make these derogatory comments about Mexicans and didn't want me to play with my good friend Ricky Hidalgo. And I was drawn to Mexican culture, and she just had this ethnocentric thing, and I thought it was so weird because she was treated like such trash as a Polish person, and here she was turning around doing the same to another group. So that kind of definitely registered with me as a kid, in whatever way it could register, that something didn't quite fit here and it wasn't right. And then the fact that I was raised Catholic, and my mother would always say, you know, don't play with those Protestants. And I go, but why? But why? You know, I was that kind of kid. Well, we just don't play with Protestants because we're Catholic. And, you know, it's like, but my friend Linda, I like her. You know, what difference does this make? So it just really kind of imprinted my consciousness. You know, then I think being a child of the 60s and being raised in that generation with, you know, all the civil rights movement all around and baby boomer mentality and all that kind of Vietnam. And then in college, I was in the first women's studies course in this country, actually.
Where was that?
That was at St. Joseph's College in Indiana, and was taught by a wonderful Jewish feminist named Judith Nisman Taylor, who was from the University of California, Berkeley, and University of Chicago, just ended up at the small Catholic college I was going to. And she created the first Women in Literature course in the country. The others were like out in California, but here was this one. And I just happened to be in her class, 20 of us students taking the first Women in Lit class, and that was 1971.
Didn't you take part in some women's movement activism, and weren't you part of a somewhat famous or infamous protest at one time?
Yes, a founding member of the grassroots group of second-class citizens, which includes Mary Lee Sargent, Bernice Carroll, Jane Mraz, and a number of other women, and we chained ourselves June 3rd, was that 1982 or 81, at Springfield, and created quite the stir. And so that group was formed here, and we were very much focused on wanting to show our disgust at the Equal Rights Amendment being voted down.
When we talk about diversity, people usually think of it in racial terms, but doesn't diversity encompass lots of other groups and lots of other ways of thinking about people?
Oh, yeah. It includes religious differences, cultural differences, socioeconomic class. Those are huge differences. Huge differences. And most people don't see that. I just wrote a column not too long ago for the paper called Identity Crisis, What's Class Got to Do with It? Sexual orientation. Issues of ability, disability, all kinds of differences.
Diversity as a word has become so loaded these days. What do we even mean when we say we honor diversity?
I think some of those phrases like we honor diversity and we tolerate diversity just kind of are expressions to just be in denial, because you can't honor without having education. Most people want to say we honor and respect, you know, like Rodney King said, why can't we just all get along? You know, like we could just have a magical potion or just say it and it'll make it true. And it doesn't, because most of us are ignorant of cultural differences. We have no knowledge about other groups. And a lot of us are resistant to it. And so one of the things that I try to do is to educate people about cultural difference and to show that with education is you do have an understanding, and you can grow into having some kind of mutual exchange and respect for other cultural groups. But without any education, you can't magically say that.
You've really been active in diversity education, especially in the last decade or so, even starting your own company, Diversity Works, Inc. Tell us about some of the educational activities that you've been doing.
Started actually doing diversity education with businesses in the community. Through Parkland College, we wanted an initiative on diversity, and we were very interested in working with businesses. And so one of the first organizations we worked with was Busey Bank. That was about 10 years ago. So as we started working, devising a whole program to educate businesses about diversity, started thinking, why am I working with them? Why am I not working with my own colleagues, educators? Because educators have been remiss on addressing difference. And they always seem to kind of be behind business in a way. Because business, in 1987, when the Hudson Institute report came out, they seized upon the predictions of changing demographics and started doing all kinds of diversity training. And major corporations like Xerox and IBM and Avon and Digital. And so they saw the writing on the wall. And here it was so many years later, and education wasn't really looking at it, even though the populations in public schools were changing drastically, etc. And so that's when I put together a whole program called the Cultural Diversity in Education Program designed for educators, and had a grant for a number of years from the Board of Higher Education to be working with the regional schools, K-12, as well as community colleges and universities. And so I did a lot of that. And then the grant went away, and I thought, I just want to keep doing this work. And I already had a model, and it was very well received. And so that's why I formed my own company, to work with other educators also who want to do this. And it's been pretty successful. I've worked with all kinds of institutions, community colleges, universities, and K-12 schools.
Let's talk about resistance to the message, to the messages. What stops people from, say, diverse hiring?
Well, there's a myth that, you know, that if we hire minorities, people of color, people who are culturally different, that somehow quality is affected, that they don't have the best qualifications. Hence, in ads, qualified minorities are welcome to apply. We don't say in an ad, qualified white people. You know, we just assume that white equals qualified. And so that mentality is really present in higher education in particular. And so that prevents us from, you know, looking at someone who's different. Also, there's in higher ed, there's just this mentality of just hiring someone from your same school, with your same background, your same interests, and usually that's going to be someone just like you. So why do we hire people like us? Because that's who we think are the most qualified people who we want on our team. So we don't usually say, let's really get someone who's different, who really thinks differently, teaches differently, does different research, because we need someone really to kind of, you know, get us going and to think differently. That's not what usually happens. Mm-hmm. Even though we might say, as educators, that it's this that creates knowledge, this kind of energy. But the reality is, and I've seen it over and over again, I've served on search committees, I've been in higher ed for 30 years, how that just, we replicate ourselves. Right now, in the next 5 years, is a window of opportunity because of all the retirements to change that. Mm-hmm. Because the student body in higher ed is changing rapidly. You know, in about 5 to 8 years, white students are going to start becoming the minority. Their numbers are going to decrease. The numbers of African Americans and Latinos are going to go up. And who's going to be teaching them? 90% white faculty and staff. And there's a disconnect there. There's a disconnect. And there are a lot of advantages to having diverse faculty and staff. But I don't think educators see those advantages.
It seems like a contradiction in terms. I thought education is supposed to be about enlightening people, broadening horizons, and all that.
Well, yes, that's true, but it's also about the status quo and keeping things as they are. And because I have a nostalgia for this curriculum that I learned from, I want to keep teaching it the same way. And so there's a lot of that in higher ed, where mm-hmm. people get latched on to their way of teaching, what they teach, and for someone to come in and present a different way makes them feel like somehow they're being questioned or their expertise is being undermined or whatever. So there's a lot of that kind of pecking order stuff in higher ed.
Champaign schools are responding to a consent decree and are trying to raise achievement levels for African American students. Any advice for them?
Well, one of the things I've learned working with a school district in Ohio, where here's a superintendent who's a white male superintendent, about 40 years old, who came to this community between Cincinnati and Dayton and was told, given by his board, you know, here are four main issues and diversity was one of them. And so he proactively looked for someone to work with, found us, and they haven't been sued, so they're not in a reactive mode. And as a result, the way things are unfolding in this community, the way they're addressing diversity with their teachers and staff, and they have an achievement gap, so that's the motivating factor. But they're moving in a way that has undercut resistance. The Champaign School's big mistake, very early on, which is surprising given that we're in this university community, that Champaign-Urbana would have been proactive just like this superintendent and said, we need to do this now. But they waited until there was a suit, a reaction from African Americans in the community, and that has just put everybody's back up against the wall. And they fought it, and they're still fighting it. And as long as they're in that reactive mode, things are not going to change.
Well, I think one of the most illuminating things that came out was when a number of years ago, I think it was the 99-2000 school year, when there was a survey, a racial climate survey, and basically the respondents who were white said that there were no problems in the Champaign schools, and the respondents who were African American, and that included staff, students, and parents, said that there were big problems, mm-hmm. and there was such a divide in terms of the perceptions.
Well, that comes from, first of all, ignorance, of not ever really talking to African-American parents and really hearing what their perspective is. It comes from no knowledge whatsoever. And white people, and I am white, you know, are always in this mentality of, I'm not racist. And their sensibility about racism is meaning, I haven't lynched anybody, I haven't hit anybody. But every day, racist stereotypes, acting on those, thinking those, sitting in a classroom and not looking an African-American student in the face or not calling on them, that's racism.
Pauline, in your work in diversity, you've actually gone throughout the country. Have you seen a place where it works, where people really get that everybody benefits from having an inclusive workplace or school system?
The key is high expectations for all students. That we don't just immediately lower our expectations because we have an Appalachian white student or a black male student or a Latino student who doesn't speak English very well or a student who has maybe dyslexia, that we keep our expectations high. And that all has to do with teachers and staffs, their own prejudice about who is an achiever and who is not, and who's going to be successful and who's going to not. And so we have to, when a school district and a community and teachers and staff see every student and every family as having high expectations for achievement and success and contributing to the community, that's what really makes the difference. That is absolutely the key. The other key besides high expectations is making sure that that education serves as a window and a mirror for every student. And I'm stealing Emily Stiles' metaphor, curriculum as window and mirror, a high school teacher from New Jersey, English teacher, where she says everyone should have a mirror so they can see their own experience, their own history, their own group reflected, but they also have a window to appreciate others. And I think those two things, high expectations, windows and mirrors, those are the key.
Chief Alinowick persists as the mascot for the University of Illinois. What's your feeling about that?
He definitely needs to go. And what really bothers me about the whole position of those who say they want to preserve it is that they are honoring the Native Americans. And it's just like I think about in a relationship of any two people in a friendship or a marriage or a partnership or intimate relationship, and one says to the other, you know, this is the way I'm going to represent you. And you say, I don't want to be represented that way. That's not who I am. And the other person says, no, but I'm honoring you. So you must accept it. It's a sick relationship. It's a sick, dysfunctional dynamic.
Pauline, America has been called a melting pot, and then later it was called a salad bowl. These are ways of describing how different groups come together and create this wonderful country. What is your vision for a multicultural society?
I kind of like, Rion Eisler, who wrote The Chalice and the Blade? She was here speaking maybe about 15 years ago, compared dominator societies to partnership societies, and particularly looking at men and women. And I like to see it as a partnership society rather than a dominator, because that's what we're in now. And that's that power dynamic where one says, I'm going to represent you this way and you better like it because I've got the power. That's a dominator, rather than a partner saying, okay, you don't like it? I guess I should listen to that. Let's think about what we could do together to solve this. And that's the way I'd like to see it, as more of a partnership, that people get to preserve their cultural identity. They don't have to melt down, because I think one of the things white people are so, if I may put it, pissed off about is that they did melt, and they lost their language, they lost their traditions. I happen to be fortunate because I can remember Polish being spoken in my mother's family. I know what went on at Christmas with the pierogies, and I still make those every year. If you lose your history of your cultural ethnic group, you in a sense have lost a part of yourself. And so they've melted, and then here come the Latinos going, we're not melting, we're not giving up our language. Because I'm really ticked off that I do not know how to speak Polish. I was in a Polish-speaking household. Those sisters were arguing in Polish. My grandfather only spoke Polish. There were Polish newspapers lying around. And my mother wouldn't let me learn it. If we could have a society where people don't have to melt, and that we could see that from all these different cultural traditions, you know, if they're all partnered together, there would be so much learning. I mean, look what we could learn from Native American culture, or black culture, Jewish culture, all of these cultures.
Pauline Case, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Pauline Case is the president of Diversity Works, Inc. She is also a newspaper columnist and a scholar who works to promote diversity education in our schools and workplaces. Pauline Case is good to know. For IMC Radio, this is Undine Gross. Thank you.
From the trenches at the Chicago IMC, reporter Rita Sands posted the following report on controversial research being funded at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
UIC researchers and officials answered questions from a concerned audience on Thursday about the $15.7 million grant they have received from the NIH to produce an antidote to ciprofloxacin-resistant anthrax. Officials, including Professors Michael Johnson, Alex Nafach, and Dr. James Cook, flanked by Vice Chancellor Charles Rice, safety personnel, and police, tried to quell the concerns of many who gathered from the Molecular Biology Research Building, or MBRB, where the research is being done, and other concerned citizens from both on and off campus. Johnson began the meeting by displaying an abstract published in July by researchers at Arizona State University and Johns Hopkins that demonstrates the ability to select ciprofloxacin-resistant strains of anthrax. Such research defies the 1972 International Biological Weapons Convention, the 1925 Geneva Protocol, and is condemned by the Federation of American Scientists. UIC officials said they would not be using a pathogenic strain to develop their antidote to cipro-resistant anthrax, and they insisted that their research had no connection to the military or to the production of cipro-resistant anthrax. But when asked how they would test a new drug, their plan indeed involved both the military and anthrax production. Professor Johnson.
We will test against anthrax, but it will be done at another location. We will do it through subcontract with Los Alamos or with Fort Detrick. It will not be done at UIC.
Where the potent anthrax strains would come from, he didn't say. But the presentation on the part of UIC officials stressed the urgency of such a project because, as Professor Alex Nafach stated, it would be easy for terrorists to produce cipro-resistant strains.
I just wanted to clarify that outside of either one of these two labs in Arizona or Johns Hopkins, to your knowledge, do you know of any cipro-resistant strains in existence at this moment, outside of those two labs?
Yes, there was some work done in NIH. I believe it was published in 2000. And they obtained a floxacin-resistant strain, Stern strain, which is resistant to floxacin, which is the same type of antibiotic as ciprofloxacin. So theoretically, unless they destroyed their resistant strains, like we destroyed our resistant strains to avoid public relation disaster, there is at least one more place.
Okay, so you're saying that you did produce one and you destroyed
it? Not anthrax. It was Bacillus cereus, which is a very close relative of anthrax, but which is not pathogenic.
Okay, but you're saying that another U.S. lab, but outside of the U.S. and the U.S. labs, do you know of any cipro-resistant strains of anthrax?
Outside of these three labs, which is NIH and this tool, I don't know of any, although it is an open, it is not a secret that it's extremely easy to make.
But very difficult to weaponize it.
Oh, yeah.
In addition to admitting that they know of no cipro-resistant anthrax in existence outside of U.S. labs, researchers also agreed that the anthrax exposures in 2001 have also been traced to strains grown in U.S. labs, which prompted many safety questions, including the one from a UIC student.
My concern is this. Given the fact that this research has been conducted already here at UIC, unbeknownst to the faculty, the staff, and the students that go here, with the exception of maybe some people in this building who were aware of it, what assurances do we really have that no anthrax itself is going to be physically present in this building? And also, I know people that work in this building that are concerned that the only real security, it seems, is that the door to the lab is card access. I mean, that seems very, very low security in this day and time. And I would also, you know, urge you to maybe be more forthcoming in the future about types of research that's being conducted here. Just to tell us there's a biocontainment lab here simply isn't enough. You know, we have the right to know exactly what kind of research is being conducted here because it does impact, you know, our lives. You know, as the gentleman here said, you know, perceptions from the outside are very important as well. if it's perceived that there's some sort of anthrax here, what's to stop someone from the outside coming in and trying to obtain it and not harming faculty, staff, or whoever in the process?
You raised a number of good points. The first issue, in terms of assurance that anthrax will not be here, it requires CDC clearance to access the virulent strains of anthrax. We have no intention of acquiring those strains. So the process, and as Jim Cook can tell you, the process for acquiring CDC clearance is not trivial. So as far as that goes, there's basically no access that we will attempt to acquire anthrax. And it will, for us to acquire the strains of anthrax that would be potentially threatening, would be reviewed at the highest levels of the university. So it would be an extensive review process and very widely checked. In fact, it would require FBI background checks. Jim, perhaps I should go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to address your first point first, because I think that there's a misconception. The idea that something's being done in secret at the University of Illinois Chicago is incorrect. The process that Chip Rice mentioned that we went through for a better part of a year, and certainly for some months in earnest, to educate the public, to educate the faculty, to educate the students, was, I think, unprecedented, at least in my experience, in 25 years of doing biodefense-like research, you could say, biocontainment research.
Dr. Cook is referring to forums that took place about building a biocontainment facility on campus, not this research in particular. Concerning safety, Dr. Cook said the campus received high marks in security after a review by an outside firm. Safety issues dominated the debate, but a few ethical questions emerged, like this one from a UIC faculty member.
Do I understand you correctly that the project that you're describing is part of the U.S. policy to develop bacterial agents for use in war? That is to say, even though you're talking about an antidote, isn't that in fact part of the total program? Why I'm asking that, so you can tell me if I'm correct in understanding it that way, as you described, is another facility that's going to produce the actual strains of anthrax that could be used for mass destruction. If, in fact, this part of the program fits in with the other part, isn't there a really serious moral question about the development of biological weapons of mass destruction?
There is certainly a serious moral question about development of weapons of mass destruction, but that is not what we're engaged in. We're engaged strictly in biodefense issues.
How can you separate the two?
This project was reviewed by the National Institutes of Health, which is an agency whose sole mission is the health of the citizens of the United States of America. We're focusing solely on the development of antibiotics. There is no way that what we're doing can be meshed with the development of bioweapons. I simply don't see any connection between
them. You described it as a connection. You said elsewhere they're doing this. Isn't it a fact that if something is developed to protect American citizens against the virulent strains of bacteria, that that is part of a war program where other citizens in other places in the world would be subject to attack? So that the defense and attack are really part of one thing.
It will be compounds that are produced as antibiotics that will be available worldwide. So how does it in any way provide an advantage for us?
How does that get distributed worldwide?
Pharmaceutical companies. That's the only way it's going to get manufactured.
The meeting was halted a little after its scheduled hour, and remaining questioners were directed to go to a website, www.biodefense.uic.edu, or email the professors individually. We're coming to you from the trenches.
That wraps up IMC Radio News. Contributors include Ondine Gross and Rita Sands. Taking us out this evening is Darren Derda, IMC volunteer and the nexus of Darren Derda's Theory of Everything, which will be releasing their first CD at a party this Friday at the Channing Murray at 8 p.m. Take care and see you next week.
I remember Mary, among women she was blessed. showed me all the best.